I mean, everyone benefits to some degree from services from the federal government. They should, in different degrees, obviously, but they should at least know what they're paying for those services. You know what you pay usually for services you contract for on your own, whether tutoring, you know, music lessons, getting the oil changed, et cetera, et cetera. You have a right to know what you're paying for. So the VAT has some problems with it, and I'm not unhappy that the panel seems to be disinclined to do a wholesale swap. However, some of the reports indicate, although they don't want to do a wholesale swap, they're looking at it down the line as a, quote, add-on for other functions. In fact, Connie Mack, the chairman of the panel, was quoted or paraphrased as saying they might look at that in the future for funding retirement accounts or some kind of pension benefit from the federal government. Well, here's the worst of both worlds, my friend.
Yeah,
you keep the income tax system the way it is with some tinker in the margins. Then you slap on a VAT, which would certainly start at a low rate and creep up on us to pay for some nice benefit. And where are you taking the United States? Right into Europe. That's the European social finance model. Have lots of benefits paid for by multiple taxes, especially by the VAT, which is a hidden tax. And Europe, for those who don't know, is growing at 1 or 2% consistently a year less than the United States. They're not creating jobs at our rate. They're not able to fund the massive social benefits they want to give their people. The exception to that is starting to appear in the what Don Renslow calls the New Europe, that is the emerging nations, the former Eastern Europe, the Baltic states, and to some extent Russia. But old Europe is still kind of stuck on the old big government, high tax model. And I'm concerned that if this tax reform panel gets it wrong, they're going to be nudging us in that direction. And I would disagree, by the way, with the announced that we're inherently necessarily going to slip into recession, but I agree that there are warning signs. One of the that you mentioned is energy prices, which is not a terribly controllable item, not in the short run. Another is interest rates creeping up, which is what monetary policy may require at this point, but you still have to consider it's not a growth-oriented move any more than high energy prices are. The Bush administration, at least at the moment, because of the costs of Hurricane Katrina and other reasons, has backed off immediate efforts to push through the remaining extensions of the Bush tax cuts from 2003 and 2001, i.e., tax increases down the line. Not this year, maybe not next, but down the line they would be higher than otherwise predicted. The Bush administration also what lapsed the 2003 provision for writing off a certain amount of new investment in plant equipment, which was a good goose to the economy for a year. These are all individual items that by themselves might not spell a certain story, but if you put them together and you look at a panel that's supposed to be looking at fundamental tax reform and seem to be pointing at marginal changes at best and possibly tax increases down the line, that doesn't smell like a positive recipe to me for economic growth for the rest of this decade.
No, no, it really doesn't. And you're absolutely right. The one I've been warning listeners about is the horror of horrors. Don't let them talk you into adding a national sales tax.
Views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to this evening's edition of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw. I'm here with my co-host, Roy Avila. Good evening, Roy.
Good evening, Michael. How are you?
Well, I'm excited. Tonight we're going to have a double-packed show. The first hour, we're going to delve back into the philosophical roots that really are governing and guiding our society today, not roots that many people understand and fewer people would support if they understood it. And then in the second hour, we're going to get down to the practical application. We're going to talk about habitat conservation plans, just another one of those strange applications of the Endangered Species Act that is wreaking such havoc upon American society and on private property specifically all across the nation. But to move along into our first hour, you know, tonight it's the continuing exposé on how positivist philosophy of Auguste Comte drives sustainable development. We're going to have a first-time guest, Mrs. Erica Carl, who will demonstrate how positivism accounts for the modern philosophical origins of the environmental movement, how it is really shaping the reordering of the family dynamic, and how it is the central idea for causing a centralization of economic and political power. We call it public-private partnerships, and so much more. You know, if we don't have an understanding of positivist philosophy and the origins of that through the philosopher Auguste Comte back in the early 19th century, we really will miss how it is that today's society is being driven. Our guest, Erica Carl, is an independent researcher and writer. She has a bachelor's degree from the University of Wisconsin. She's taught math and composition at private schools in Wisconsin. For 10 years, she wrote a weekly column called Truth in Education for the Wisconsin Report. And she served as editor for education editor for that publication. Her books are Give Us the Young, Why Things Are the Way They Are, and a loose-leaf collection of quotes entitled Six Generations to Serfdom. She's a writer who publishes at News with Views, and she had an article published on October 17th entitled Shaping Your Future Whether You Like It or Not. Erica, are you with us? We don't have Erica up on the phone line yet. But
we're trying to get a hold of her. You know, you were sharing with me before we got on this evening, some of the things that were in this article, which, when you were sharing them with me, it was almost scary how the writings of that time, what this guy was doing, is exactly what we talk about on this program and what's going on right now.
Well, it is. I mean, the subjects about which Auguste Comte has written about is the life and the policy that we live with all the time today. Erica is with us. Erica, we've made an introduction of you to the audience with your background as a writer and educator, and welcome to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show this evening.
Thank you.
Well, it's going to be a pleasure, and I'm excited to hear the replays of this show myself once we're done here tonight. You know, you write, how can shaping the future be so easy? Auguste Comte, who lived from 1798 to 1857, is the father of sociology and the religion of humanity. We're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show.
Okay.
We're back while some stations take a commercial break with Erica Carl, our guest, and continuing with the quote from your recent writing on Auguste Comte, you say that he devoted his entire intellectual life to plans for shaping the future.
Right.
He published a six-volume Positive Philosophy, and then he wrote his four-volume System of Positive Polity, more of a political application, and then his, which was four volumes, and then he wrote his Catechism of the Positive Religion, which capped off his career, in order to instruct his followers about the methods to shape the future.
Yes.
So, boy, we have done shows on August Comte, and tell us more, and tie some of the quotes that that you have dredged up from the past, and show us how they apply to our society today.
Okay. Well, Comte lived from 1798 to 1857, and during the time of his youth, things had changed quite a bit. The Catholic Church in France had lost quite a bit of its power. Science was making great strides, and people were getting more conveniences, and life was getting better. Comte said, "This was all wonderful. However, we're going to have to get control of things again." And he reasoned out that in order to get control of people and of government and of the future, he would have to first get control of science. And in order to get control of science, he originated his own, what he called a new science, sociology, or social science, he called it. Then he wanted to get control of religion. And in order to get control of religion, he decided that he would form his own new religion, which he called the religion of humanity. His teacher, Saint Simone, had called it humanitarianism. If you look at very much older dictionaries, you'll find that humanitarianism, which sometimes even Christian ministers are happy to be called humanitarian, but the original definition of humanitarianism is the doctrine that denies the divinity of Christ. Did you know that?
No, I didn't, but I would presume that Auguste Comte would also want to deny the spiritual base of any of the world's major religions.
Yeah, well, he was raised Catholic, and he disappointed his parents considerably when he went to the gym.
We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our guest, Erica Carlin. We're talking about the background of Auguste Comte as he was raised and became an adult in the early 19th century.
And we said he wanted to get control of science and religion in order to control people and the future. And to control science, he invented sociology or social science, and to control religion, he invented his own religion of humanity. And he figured that people who believed in God would eventually all get together in one great Catholic Church. Those who didn't believe in God would follow his humanitarian religion, and eventually, over the generations, they would merge and we'd have a one-world religion.
So a one-world religion controlled by
sociology,
new science, and sociology controlling
right.
The sciences.
He was a brilliant man. In fact, some of the things that write about him say that he wrote whole books. He worked it out in his mind, and then he just sat down and wrote from beginning to end. He was probably he was a mathematician, really. And probably a genius at organizing thoughts about how to control the future, and he covered every subject. I collected a lot of these quotes, and I said, many believe the moral and educational deterioration of recent generations just happened, but research shows the decline was planned and executed intentionally. The goal is a totally managed world dictatorship to replace constitutional government and national sovereignty.
Now, did Comte address those issues?
Oh, absolutely. I divided my quotes into 14 different divisions, and these are the things that have to be accomplished in order to take over. I'm not saying there are only 14, but I have quotes from Comte to start out the first generation, and then I go through six generations, and it's six generations to serfdom. The first thing he had to do was replace Christianity with the positive religion, abolish monarchy, the third, institute and expand communistic principle, the fourth, limit education and establish sociological control, the fifth, and here's where you've been very interested, control the environment to control mankind and clean the land. Sixth, destroy moral authority and crush personality. Seventh, control public opinion. And he said that the public opinion had to be shaped and controlled, and that the world would be directed by public opinion. The eighth was liberalize sexual attitudes and behavior. The ninth, destroy the natural family and diminish the male role. Tenth, establish evolutionary theory and control sciences.
Now pause for just a minute. I think the listener ought to reflect on these first ten and ask themselves, so certainly if they're a regular listener to Freedom 21, if they have heard elements of the application of each of these concepts in the real world of today.
It's all there. And, you know, people get, the sociological types get all upset when you talk about creation or evolution. Well, the reason for this is because sociology is based on what they call cultural evolution. And Comte felt that evolution was part of the basic principle, and he needed biological evolution in order to have something to base it on. And should I go on with the
yes, go
last
on
one?
With the remainder of the
promote global integration, invest political power in the wealthy and industrial leaders.
And today we call that public-private partnership.
Yeah. Establish cities as humanity's centers of operation.
And that's called smart growth.
Yeah, that's true. Replace the Constitution with a world management system.
And that's called the United Nations.
Right. And all these things he carried out and told people how to handle it. And there were followers of Comte who gave their instructions in the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. And today, look at sociology. It's in every college and every high school.
Well, I like to say that our whole secondary academic institution within America has really just become a Comtean academic experience. You go in with fresh ideas and you come out a sociologist, and that's whether you are dealing in physical sciences or majoring in maybe almost anything but accounting.
Well... Accounting was probably closest to what he was a mathematician, so they probably get something there, too.
Well, as we move to this concept of triple bottom line accounting, which is being pushed by some serious accountants around this country, we begin to find that even accounting is afflicted by the Comtean disease.
Well, you know, in order to realize the goal of a world management system, you have to get the cooperation of people, whether it's ignorant or knowledgeable cooperation. And this is one thing they learned at Harvard. In order, if you're going to make changes, the best way to do it and to get cooperation is get the people involved in the change to assist in making the change. And many people don't realize how their involvement through some of the organizations they join and give sanction for them to be represented, how they are helping bring about this management system.
Well, in my conversations with you, you pointed out one glaring example of that, at least glaring in my mind, and that was the Chamber of Commerce.
We would not have a United Nations if it weren't the Chamber of Commerce.
Well, explain
and
that, please.
The Chamber of Commerce wanted the United Nations because there's an economic and social council within the United Nations, and the economic and social council has consultants from what they call NGOs. NGOs are non-governmental organizations, and it's getting to the point these non-governmental organizations, the Chamber of Commerce, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, I should say, being one of the primary ones. And they consult with the United Nations and tell the United Nations what they think should be done. The United Nations makes it a world policy. It communicates that to the legislators of the various countries, and the Chamber of Commerce is an extremely, extremely powerful organization. Then Washington passes legislation that conforms to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce demands or requests, and oftentimes the local members of the Chamber of Commerce don't like what's coming forth. They have no idea that it was their own organization through the United Nations that promoted it, because it comes around indirectly. It's a nice setup for the world government promoters, because they can promote these things and be anonymous about it.
Well, it really is an application, isn't it, of the consensus process. It's really a higher tier application of the Delphi technique. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. I think so. You know, when they set up these local meetings for sustainable development, and I've attended quite a few of them, they always are looking for consensus. It's actually sometimes kind of fun to go to these meetings, because they can have 100 or 150 people there, and if they're sincere and looking for consensus, one person can ruin the whole thing, because if everybody doesn't agree, they don't have consensus. So sometimes they'll just break up the meeting and say, well, we'll schedule our next meeting for such and such and hope they can do better the next time. But one person can get in the way of the whole thing.
Well, we've certainly disclosed and discovered many examples in that mode, and of course, if that doesn't make sense to the listener, the best way to begin to understand that is read Bev Ekman's workbook called Understanding Group Manipulation and How to Counter It.
Well, that sounds like a good one.
You know, it's beautiful. It's about a 70-page handbook, and it'll describe what they do, how they do it, why they do it, what their goals are, and how it is that you can take this phony consensus process off its track. And it really is just by not falling prey to the group manipulation, the public opinion that Comte was so foresighted in understanding how to create a group mentality and how to use public opinion to monitor, guide, and really direct public action. And if you see through that and get down to the truth and the reason of what's going on, simply by asking reasoned questions, you can throw this phony and contrived consensus process off track. And every county in the country is going through this dynamic now, and that's why understanding group manipulation tactics becomes
and
so important.
You wonder sometimes, how can it show up in every country, in every county, and all over the country at the same time? Not only all over our country, but other countries that are doing the same thing. And when you realize how powerful is the Chamber of Commerce, and how often, I would say, Chamber of Commerce people are usually involved in setting up these meetings, you can begin to understand how it can be a worldwide situation.
Well, I think that's a beautiful application of taking what they always said in the 80s here in Santa Cruz, the global to local dynamic, and how it's been made to come true. And, you know, here in Santa Cruz, there's no question that the Chamber of Commerce's in our communities have been major players in doing that. We're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our special guest, Erica Carl. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz with our guest, Erica Carl, as we continue through the breakaway for some of our stations while they do some advertising. And let's just continue the conversation, Erica.
Before we move on, Erica, this is Roy Avila. You said something earlier about what was going on at Harvard. You know, Harvard, for many folks in this country, is one of the most respected institutions of higher learning. What went on and what's going on at Harvard?
Well, Harvard, for one thing, they tell people how to adjust for the change or how to get people to adjust for the change. But another thing that Harvard has is what's called the Harvard Management System. And starting in the 1940s, top executives from many of the largest corporations went to Harvard. I think it was a six-week training course, and they would learn this Harvard Management System. And the difference between what happened with the Harvard Management System and what the way things used to be, in the Harvard Management System, you're managing the men. Used to be, if you had a business, you managed your business. But it was definitely management of men. And when I've written various articles about the Harvard Management System, I usually abbreviate it with HAR for Harvard Management System. So I call it the HARMS system. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense, too. But there's a big difference between managing your business and trying to manage the people and their lives.
Well, managing men or managing people is the essence of seeking control over people. And I've always thought that there's nothing really more rotten than the effort to take control of the life of someone else. And that's really what we end up with the philosophy of positivism, is it not?
That's right. That was the total intent. The first thing that brought me to Kant, I was researching another person. It was actually Edward Bellamy. And it mentioned he wrote the book Looking Backward, which was a fictional design for a perfect socialistic system that was going to take place in the year 2000. And how Bellamy had been strongly influenced by reading Comte. And I thought, well, I've got to find out who this Auguste Comte is. And I went to my older editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica. It was the 14th edition, which was about 1906. And in that it said, this is a quote from Comte, "In the name of the past, and of the future, the servants of humanity, both its philosophical and its practical servants, come forward to claim as their due the general direction of the world. Their object is to constitute at length a real providence in all departments, moral, intellectual, and material. Consequently, they exclude, once for all, from political supremacy, all the different servants of God, Catholic, Protestant, or Deist, as being at once behindhand and a cause of disturbance." And the whole article gave a great deal about Comte's life and his goals, and actually, it would have been enough to convince me.
Excuse me, Erica. We're back at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show for stations that have broken away. With Erica Carl, and for the last few minutes we've been talking about how positivism, the philosophy of positivism, is the attempt to control all human action. And Erica has quoted Comte's vision in that regard, his vision for shaping the future of today, and she's referred to the author Bellamy, his first name I forgot.
Edward Bellamy.
Edward Bellamy in his book Looking Backward. Now Bellamy, of course, was a very famous and one of the first Fabians in America. All of whom, my early research seems to indicate were drawn to Comte and his philosophy. So to the extent we have political action surviving today through people like Tony Blair, the past chairman of the Fabian Social Society, we've got a political action organization that is rooted in the philosophy of Auguste Comte, and just gives us another reason to be concerned about understanding what positivist philosophy is and where it came from and how it's affecting us today as this grand change that teachers talk about.
From the 1890s on, Bellamy's book, Looking Backward, was extremely popular. And being a fictionalized version, it was designed to affect the emotions of the reader. And it sold all over the world. And after the book came out, there were Bellamy clubs formed throughout the world. And one of the people who lectured on Edward Bellamy was Annie Besant of the Theosophical Society. And there's another person, I don't know how much you've talked about Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society, but Madame Blavatsky was extremely much influenced by what Comte wrote. And part of the doctrines that she used to set up her society come from Comte and the ideas she got from Comte.
Erica, this is Roy Avila again. Who was Comte influenced by?
A philosopher named Saint-Simon, for one. And I think there was one called Condorcet. And, you know, you can go back farther and farther and farther. And I haven't really gone back that much into those people, because Comte gave me everything I needed to understand what was going on today.
Was there anything in your research, was there anything that happened in his life, or, you know, because usually when you read about these people, something happens to them, and then they react in a certain way to move in
well,
a direction.
Well, you know, he was born right after the French Revolution, and there was probably quite a bit of talk against the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church was losing power. He decided he was much too smart to be a member of the Church, and he thought that he could invent a much better religion. Now, he thought of his religion as, with all the system of the Catholic Church, but he wanted to get rid of this Jesus fellow. So, in his mind, the religion of humanity was Catholicism without Jesus.
Concept being a universal church, the meaning
of the
Catholic.
That's right, universal church.
Yes.
And that was the same concept that Blavatsky had and the followers of her side.
Wow.
It's a big, complicated thing, but I find it easier to understand what was going on as soon as I found Comte, and it's a tree with a lot of branches, and you can hang things on every different branch, and they all are related to each other, and you can understand how they can cover so much territory.
And he had a comprehensive system to include a comprehensive management of humanity.
Well, now, each of those books of the Positive Polity is, I think the least is probably about 400 pages. I would say they're at least 2,000 pages of instructions how to set up the system. And then he also had that religion of positive religion catechism. And early he got a lot of followers through the system of, through the positive philosophy. So he had plenty of instruction for those intellectuals who wanted to read all his volumes and figure out how to do things.
Wow.
I think maybe the top sociologists now have access to the volumes, but they aren't easy to find.
Well, he's certainly not taught much in colleges today.
No, I took a sociology course. They never told me who originated it.
My. We're going to be right back at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and when we do, we're going to talk about Comte and environmentalism and what influence that may be having today. We'll be right back.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
We're back here before some of our stations return with us to continue our discussion with Erica Carl on August Compte. For the listening audience, probably what a 15-page summary of some classic quotes from August Compte and his various volumes is available to you if you go into our radio page. That's f21sc.net/radio. You can have a link to the article that was recently published by Erica, and it is a breathtaking read. If you're familiar at all with what's really underlying sustainable development and its movements that are cross-cutting our society, and read what Compte wrote nearly 200 years ago. It may not be taught to the average sociology student, but boy, somebody is reading this stuff, and that somebody is taking these words to their natural conclusion and is bringing us this this massive change in our society and around the world. You want to check out these quotes that Erica has compiled and has published in a recent article.
I think you'll find the one that I have first on the group that I sent to you. Environment controls mankind. In order to regulate or combine mankind, religion must in the first instance place man under the influence of some external power, possessed of superiority so irresistible as to leave no uncertainty about it. The great principle of sociology, of social science, is at bottom merely...
Hold that thought for a second, Erica. We'll be right back. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw with Roy Avila, and we're talking with Erica Carl on the positivist philosophy of August Compte and its influence on today's society. And she's explaining how Compte's vision was that environment controls mankind, and that mankind needs the influence of an external power. In history, it had always been theology, and I think you're getting to the point where you're going to say he proposes that what controls mankind is the environment.
The great principle, he said, of social science is at bottom merely the full development of the primary notion of sound biology, the necessary subordination of every organism to the environment in which it is placed. A sound theory of biology thus furnishes the positive theory of religion with a foundation wholly unassailable, for it proves the general necessity for the constant supremacy of an external power as a condition for the unity of man, even in his individual life. So you see why evolution was so important to the sociologist.
You said this guy was brilliant, and it's just amazing to read that and think about how long ago that was written and how it is exactly what's going on today.
Yes, and you, I'll read you some of the headlines I put on the quotes. Earth belongs to the great being. Human species and the animal races, the animal rights movement was predicted way back then, or not predicted, projected, I suppose you could say.
Called for, in essence.
It's kind of a futurism, what he wrote. Human species relations with the animal races. The worship of plants to be restored. There you have your tree huggers. The sociological spirit has to be supreme, and that means supreme over all the other sciences.
And sociological spirit, what, means altruism, that you live your life for others, that you're really an object of community's use?
Well, he invented the word altruism, I guess you know that.
Yes.
And altruism means otherism. means that you don't think of yourself, you always think of others.
And what that really allows is for the ruling master to take control of you, because after all, your individualism has been crushed and your use is only evident if you're sacrificial to the common good.
And total interference of everybody with everybody else's life.
Okay.
One of the important things is sociology is supposed to be the disciplinarian of science, and actually direct science what to do and where to go, and be the master science over all of the other sciences. And I don't know how other scientists in other fields can allow this to happen, and allow sociology to be in a college without a protest. I can't understand it.
Funding,
that's that's for sure. And it was the Rockefeller money that did a lot to build up sociology, especially in University of Chicago, where they started. And it wasn't until pretty well into the 19th century, I mean the 20th century, that sociology got into most of the colleges. And it was a struggle for them, but as soon as the money started coming, then they all started classes in sociology.
My Erica, we have several callers on the line.
Okay.
Okay. Let's hear from Will. Will from Missouri, who is a resident student of or scholar on August Comp. Will, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Michael, and thanks for taking my call. Erica, wonderful broadcast, and I liked the article that you had with News and Fuse. I've got two questions. One of them: were you ever able in your research to come up with a reliable biography?
Of Comte?
Yes. Like a Harriet Martineau or a Richard Congreve?
There are. I think I haven't thought about that too much lately, but, you know, he had this Clotilde DeVoe or something.
Yes.
And he was madly in love with her. She was his friend, but she didn't allow him to get any closer than that, and she wouldn't have married him, and she wouldn't have gone to bed with him. And maybe that's why he wants to change things for other people. If he can't have it, they can't have it.
Well, at least he control everything around him.
Yes. But offhand, I can't think of any titles for you.
Okay. The other question is, in regards to his veneration of women as a result of the relationship with Clotilde, how do you see that coming down today in the various work that Harriet Martineau did here in the United States and in relationship to women's trends now?
Well, I think the entire women's movement was predicted. I mean, you can read Comte and you can predict political events, and he said he couldn't get his system to work without the cooperation of women. And if you're going to flatter women and call them goddesses, and that women should be worshipped, which is what he said, you can understand why a lot of these silly women follow into the women's lib movement.
And the social sciences.
Sure.
Well, I thank you for your comments, and I'll continue to listen. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
And we have another call, Roger, from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Roger, are you with us?
Yeah, thank you very much, folks. I was just glued to the show, and I want to come back to this thing about legal positivism and the word altruism in that context. And what you said about worshiping women, it kind of reminds me, C.S. Lewis said that, you know, they worship man in the abstract, yet hate him in the concrete. That is how he actually is. And I think that's a very appertaining point. This is a big joke because in Rose Martin's, it's probably now 30-plus-year-old book, The Great Deceit, The Social Pseudosciences, she shows how Comte invented, really, sociology out of whole cloth. And having read through two or three introductory sociology texts, one has to be, if one has half a brain, you have to be struck by the succession of logical non sequiturs, one after the other. And I really have to call sociology applied Marxism, because that's, I think, a better summary term than anything.
I think sociology kind of preceded Marx, didn't it?
I don't know, but I think
sociology actually is much broader in its concepts, because it just touches everything.
Yeah, and it's so irrational, like I said, with the chain of logical non sequiturs. It's really a big scandal that you can actually get PhDs in that slop. And lastly, I'll hang up then. I wanted to ask, if you wanted to explicate further on this, is that the doctrine of legal positivism goes an additional step, that whereas law was regarded prior to this doctrine, and it's used by various jurists, if not explicitly, certainly implicitly, and that is, whereas law was used to ban or punish bad behavior, the doctrine of legal positivism has it to force good behavior. And I'll leave you at that to explicate, if you please, and God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Paul, Roger. Well, Erica, do you have some reaction to Roger's comments?
Well, as far as the legislation is concerned, maybe not directly to what he said, but the sociologist and Comte wrote that legislation is no longer going to be made by the legislators. It's going to be made in what you call the sociological laboratory. And he said the legislative bodies will need to be continued, but merely to put the sanction of society on what has been drawn up in the sociological laboratory.
Well, just several weeks ago, we had a show on the Commission for Uniform State Laws, and how each state's laws really aren't made by the legislators we elect, but are made by this commission that sits behind the scene, a group of lawyers.
I suspect a lot of that is also done at the universities, like Harvard. And, before the congressmen even go to Congress, many times they go to Harvard to learn how to legislate.
My. Well, I know here in California, if you're elected to a local position, you're sent to training sessions where you get your insights on how to implement smart growth policies and other sustainable development programs. So,
you learn policy instead of law.
Exactly. And that policy is the sociological outbirth that has evolved and grown out of this positivist philosophy, which is a very scary notion for all human beings, it strikes me.
Well, and when you realize how many, you go to the library and get an encyclopedia of associations and realize how many associations there are, and there are now over 2,000 who are now members of United Nations non-governmental organizations. And when you join an organization that has policies, they're speaking for you in those policies, and they're all working with the United Nations. I mean, almost any organization you can join is connected to the United Nations, so you can see how, through leaders of these organizations, it goes into all the communities around the country, and people, it's amazing, you can go to one town or another, and everybody thinks they're original.
Well, that's certainly what we see with these visioning processes and the various guests we've had from all over the country talking about the notion of their local program, which they've been able to discover is just like the program that sits in a county across the state and sits across the state line at counties in other states, and it all ends up coming down either through federal agencies or organizations, NGO organizations you're talking about, whether it's the Chamber of Commerce.
In the local meetings years ago, they used to put butcher paper on the wall, and then they'd ask people for ideas. And you're not supposed to criticize anybody else's ideas, and they write them all down on the butcher paper. And many of them are very, very simple. And the people don't realize that anybody could think of the things that they're putting on this butcher paper. And the first meeting I went to, that somebody put something on, and then everybody would applaud and make them feel good. And now, instead of the butcher paper, 3M makes regular boards.
Yeah, they're like big post-it notes.
Big, that's right. And they have pages that turn over, and you have to know that it's being done everywhere. It would certainly not be profitable to make these big boards for people who conduct their meetings.
Well, we have meetings like that all over this county. They've gotten a lot more clever because now they won't even open it for general comments or conversation. It's usually the facilitator now who takes nearly full charge before they put you at little individual tables so that if they do have someone who understands the process and would make that information known to others, they've got them bottled up in a small table, and then they can surround that table with the wandering facilitators to keep it all under control. But this process, I would just say this, though, that back when they would use the sheets here in Santa Cruz County, if you mentioned anything having to do with private property, they'd smile at you, go, "That's a nice thought," and move right along without putting it on the board. So it wasn't that they took all ideas and put it on their little charts.
Well, and that process and that kind of training is everywhere, whether you go to a parent meeting to decide.
Well, that's using people to make changes so that they'll go along with the changes. And, you know, there are a lot of people who've never been in an important position in their life, and it's a ego boost for them.
Well, and you get that ego boost here and in many places by going to these so-called leadership courses where they teach you how to be a perfect follower and call you a leader, and you do the dirty work of the change agents that way.
Well, then you don't even really get to be a leader, because if it goes wrong, you can blame all the other people.
Well, you know, everything is leadership. It's a pyramid scheme, the guy at the top and the one underneath and the one underneath and the one underneath, and they all have a leadership position training their subordinates, but they're training them in a system that they have to be trained in before they use it.
And it's devoid of individual thought, because the criteria for this is that you accept group mentality, group thought.
Well, if you don't do what you're told, you're not doing it right.
Well, and you're off the system. We have another call, Erica, okay. Jeannie from Aptos here in Santa Cruz County. Jeannie?
Yeah, good evening. I have a question.
Speak up a little, Jeannie. It's hard to hear.
Okay. How do the Jesuit priests fit into this equation?
I didn't hear the question.
And the question was, how do the Jesuits fit into this equation? Or do they?
I think that I haven't really gone into the Jesuit philosophy or any of the Jesuit teachings, and for me, I don't know that it's that important, because there's nothing I can do about it. I'm interested in the things that I can do something about. For instance, the Chamber of Commerce, I can see them, I can touch them, I can talk to them, I can warn people about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and what they're foisting on the local groups, and it's something that I can really work with. In sociology, I can warn people, don't let your children take sociology, try to get away from the funding of sociology, but, you know, what can I do if I'm going to study the Jesuits, whether they're in it or not? There's nothing I can do about it.
Well, that's fairly well said.
Can I comment on that? Because as I understand, they have infiltrated the Catholic Church and also other churches and other front churches that they have created. And their philosophy is very much what you're talking about. They do not believe in private property. And, of course, they said that Jesus Christ was a communist. So it does fit in very precisely United States.
I agree with you on that, because I had a personal experience.
Go ahead. We have another 40 seconds or so.
Personal experience with a boy I knew. I was on a date with him, and he said, "Janet, what would you think if I told you I was a communist?" And he said that being a communist, he had been told to become a minister. And I imagine if he was told that, there were quite a few others who had been.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Jean.
Well, as we come back from another station break, we've got a few minutes left in the show, and what we want to talk about is maybe a few more examples, Erica, of how positivism affects all aspects of the human endeavor and society. We'll be right back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our last segment this hour with our special guest, Erica Kyle, author and researcher and student of the positivist philosophy of Auguste Comte, an early 19th century French philosopher who really has outlined in incredible detail a scheme for change, the kind of change that we're seeing coming at us from all aspects here today. One of the areas that really fascinated me was Comte's call for the focus on ruling families, the concentration of capital, and the combination really of government and business interests. What can you tell us about that?
I was going to go in a different direction, and I had my mind on it.
Well, go ahead.
I was going to bring up the White House Conference on Children in 1970.
Oh, and Richard Nixon is president.
Yeah, and it gets into environmentalism. I'll read you some of the headlines, and you can stop me if you want to hear more. If a child is injured, the environment must be changed. Automobiles must be limited. Ecologists must plan communities. Get more land under public ownership. This is all from the President Conference on Children.
Wow.
And then on education for environmentalism. In the 70s, they had a push for futurism. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it was very, very prominent. And there was a book out on futurism, and it said students must be shocked and shaken. In short, if a teacher really wants to change student behavior through an ecology unit, something new and fresh will have to be offered. Students need to be shocked and shaken repeatedly. Their feet must be held to the fire until they cry out in protest. We use a number of science fiction stories to revitalize tired ecology units, and most of them hit the students hard. Now, isn't that a dirty trick?
Now, is this happening in schools today?
Probably.
Okay. There's certainly a lot that goes on in the school system. And
well, this book was 1973, and I was so shaken after that I had to go and talk to my friend and practically be deprogrammed because that meeting was horrible. It was a meeting of sociologists from around the country, around the Milwaukee area.
Well, we certainly know that here in California, every class now by state directive is to have an environmentalist element in it. You can be in a math class, it's got to have an environmentalist element.
And they scare the wits out of the kids.
We'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz in a moment. We're back here for the last few minutes of this interview with Erica Kyle on positivism and the philosophy that is intended to shape our world. In the last segment, Eric has been talking about environmentalism, really dating from the 1970s, and the White House Conference on Children dated from 1970, and how it has been the policy, I guess you could say, from the federal government since that time, that the children be indoctrinated with a different set of ideas about how the environment and human beings are to relate and the order of things, really putting the environment ahead of human society and creating the control. Going back to the beginning of this show, the idea that there must be an external pressure placed upon society in order to gain the control over them, and the environment has been the agent of choice from Auguste Comte on right here to today, and as we see that really begin to flower. Continue with
that. Well, I had a question because I know we're going to lose you real soon, and I want to get this out before you go.
You know, many of us might know people who are involved in the Chamber of Commerce, and, you know, they may be well-meaning people, and you talked about, you know, being able to have an effect on things that we can do. How do you approach someone who might be in the Chamber of Commerce to kind of let them know what they might be being a part of?
I have not been too successful in approaching people in the Chamber of Commerce. You know, there are a lot of benefits for joining. I think they have insurance plans. I think they have many benefits that are financially profitable for people, and they think they need it for the business. And I think that I like to talk mostly to the people who are receptive and want to learn.
Sure.
And it's very difficult. I'm not saying you shouldn't contact the people in the Chamber of Commerce and let them know what's going on, but don't be disappointed if they won't hear you.
Well, so many people who are members of the Chamber of Commerce do it because it's a local networking group, and it allows them to meet other business people and share dynamics that benefit them.
And how can you look at all these nice people who are members of this nice organization and think that the national is not a good thing?
Well, it's the same thing with the American Farm Bureau, and it falls down to some of the local farm bureaus have the local farmers' interests in first front, and other farm bureaus, and certainly the national.
Well, I think maybe I'm going to interrupt you, because I think maybe talking to people of the Chamber of Commerce, don't tell them get out of the Chamber of Commerce. Tell them to change your local Chamber of Commerce and be aware of what they're doing and to object to what they're doing if it's not good.
Well, there's no question that the chambers in this county have, they've even had certain persons go through these chambers, and now they're off in other chambers. There's one fellow who went from here to Tracy and came from here from New Mexico, and he's just been an agent of Agenda 21 transformation.
Well, what I'm saying is very interesting. Many former politicians are now going in to be heads of chambers of commerce.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, in the next hour, our subject will be habitat conservation plans, and the man who headed up the habitat conservation plan countywide in this county then became the Chamber of Commerce president.
Uh-oh.
So it all does float and fit together. Once you
might mention I have a couple articles on the Chamber on the News with Views.
And people can get that by going to newswithviews.com and finding you as an author, and then clicking into the archive.
Texas Chamber articles.
Okay, and that's a very worthwhile thing to do. And if you want to read Erica's summary of Comte quotes, go to freedom21santacruz.net. That's f21fc.net/radio. And right there, you can click right into this article that has formed the basis of our discussion tonight. I want to thank you very much for being with us and all the great research work that you're doing. And I'm so happy that you're spreading this word far and wide.
I want to thank you for making what Comp Plan better known. It's very important.
It is very important indeed. Well, have a good week recovering from Wilma down there in Florida.
Thank you.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Welcome to the second hour of tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw with my co-host Roy Avila. And tonight, we're going to change the tune here. We're going to get down to brass tacks and real application of the kind of philosophy that we heard in the first hour. We're going to talk about habitat conservation plans, otherwise known as HCPs. Now, these are outgrowths of the Endangered Species Act, and of course we've had some dynamite shows on the Endangered Species Act. Many people know that the ESA, Endangered Species Act, is up for reauthorization. Congressman Pombo, not far here from Santa Cruz, has put the act up for a 30-year renewal. And this act, of course, cements the idea that plants and animals are more important than human beings, and if that doesn't fulfill the vision of August Comte and his philosophy of positivism, well, nothing could be more perfect in terms of what Comte was all about. And tonight we're going to discuss with a regular guest here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, Dr. Paul Dickey, who lives in the East San Francisco Bay Area. This week we're going to assess the new proposed Contra Costa County HCP, or Habitat Conservation Plan. Well, surprise, if you've seen one of these, you have seen them all. Learn what damage HCPs bring to landowners and to the communities in which they are operated. HCPs are spreading across this state and around the country very fast. We need to understand the junk science and the exorbitant costs of this sustainable development land and resource-grabbing technique. Because if we know the problem, we can cure the illness. So we're going to talk about that a bit tonight, too. Now, Dr. Dickey is a retired lecturer in a public administration program from San Francisco State, where he taught management, budgeting, and organizational behavior for 15 years. He's a lecturer in the business program at the University of Phoenix, Management, Communications, and Organizational Behavior for the last 4 years. He's a member of the National Association of Scholars, California Association of Scholars, Contra Costa Taxpayers Association, and Citizens for Responsible Government. And it's my observation that Paul Dickey is one heck of a research guru. You know, if he cites a problem, he'll get right down to the core of it, and that's what we're going to do tonight when we talk about the Contra Costa County Habitat Conservation Plan. Paul, are you with us?
I am. Thank you very much, Michael. That was very kind of you.
Well, you know, I've enjoyed the shows that you've done in the past. I've hosted some, and others have hosted others, and it's always been a bag of information that the listeners can go away with. And those shows are archived at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz /radio archive section, where you can download many, if not most, of the prior Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio shows. So you can search them and get the subject you want, or search for the guest like Paul Dickey and get some good information. We're going to be breaking away some of our stations for a couple-minute commercial break, and we're going to be right back here with our special guest, Paul Dickey, so don't go away. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio. We're going to talk about the proposed Contra Costa Habitat Conservation Plan. Well, we had a proposal like this in Santa Cruz County in the early part of this decade that blew up in smoke, literally, although they came back here in the last 6 months and put a habitat conservation plan on the San Lorenzo Valley. It wasn't countywide like the original one. They snuck this new one in. But let's focus on Contra Costa for a bit and tell us what's being planned for your county.
Okay, well, as you noted, Michael, this is a federal program. And, in fact, that was an invitation by federal agencies to Contra Costa to set up one of these. And what they're doing is, it's more than a proposal at the moment because it is going forward. They've set up about a third of the entire county, over 175,000 acres, that is to be encompassed by this plan. And it's a joint powers agreement under California law between seven agencies, between the county, the cities of Brentwood, Clayton, Oakley, Pittsburgh, and the Contra Costa Water and Conservation District and the East Bay Regional Park District. And that, those are backed up by the California State Department of Fish and Game, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and, of course, our old friend, the Environmental Protection Agency. It was set up or invited by this letter in 1998, and in January of 2000, the Board of Supervisors of the county got rolling on it, and later that year had an agreement. Now, it's really interesting that the stated purpose is to fund and develop a plan and to forward to the United States Fish and Wildlife Service and the California Department of Fish and Game to establish a funding mechanism to preserve and enhance native habitats which support endangered and sensitive species while providing, notice the word providing, local land use planning agencies with a regional incidental take permit under the Federal Endangered Species Act and the California Endangered Species Act.
Well, let's hang on for a minute and explain that a little bit, although we're going to be welcoming our audiences back here in just a few seconds. But the idea here is that, and I'm going to hold that thought. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw with my co-host Roy Avila, and we're talking to Paul Dickey about the Contra Costa County Habitat Conservation Plan. Now, Contra Costa County is east of San Francisco. It's got a population of, what, about 2 million people? Is that?
About a million.
About a million people. Mm-hmm. And one-third of the county, the eastern side of the county, with 175,000 acres, mostly rural setting, the rural side of the county, is having implemented a habitat conservation plan. Now, what this means is the federal government has come in and has joined forces, so to speak, with seven local agencies, five cities, and a couple of other public entities for creating a plan whereby potential endangered species, which may live anywhere on this 175,000 acres, could be exempted from certain provisions of the Endangered Species Act on certain provisions or provisos. Is that a fair analysis?
Yes. What it really means in practical terms is that anyone who wishes to start any activity on property, on land, has to apply for a take permit. And the take permit allows them incidental harm, as they term it, to endangered or to endangered species, even if they're not listed as species on the federal list. Now, to do this, they're going to, that is the applicant, whether that be a homeowner, a landowner, a developer, or even utility, or
farmer,
etc. Anyone who wants some kind of activity on the property has to apply for this take permit.
Now, let's suppose you've got some old pasture grass land that you own, something that's flat, doesn't have any standing or flowing water on it. It's all filled with Spanish oats and, you know, rip gut and the like. And what you want to do is build a house on it.
Right.
Are you saying that now, because you're part of this 175,000 acres, you've got to go through a process to be exempted from a, quote, take that's not even possible on your property because you didn't these endangered fairy shrimp don't even exist on your property?
Right, exactly.
What a deal.
Hey, what a deal.
This is your local agency coming to protect your private property interests from those egregious federales.
Of course.
Yeah.
The,
that's not a town I want to live in.
Well, the interesting thing, too, is that, and we'll get to some patterns later, that the HCP, the Habitat Conservation Plan, has developed an association. So they have a HCP association, which is kind of a working group represented by many of the same people, plus some of the private environmental agencies, of course,
NGOs.
As usual, NGOs.
Yeah.
GGOs, yeah.
Global Governance Organizations.
Or GGOs, Green Government Organizations.
Okay.
Anyway, they have developed this association, and they have a direct voice in what's happening here.
Because they've been deemed stakeholders in the interests of private property.
Right.
I mean, what we're going to see here is an application of Kelo without compensation, just a taking for for local government's desire.
Right. And what they have done and are doing is to establish a governing board for this new organization, the HCP, with, of course, an executive director. The board is made up of representatives from these seven agencies, and their job is to oversee compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act, the National Environmental Protection Act, the Policy Act, and to make sure that nothing happens in here that would be a violation.
Paul, this is Roy Avila. I know these stakeholder groups have filet mignon tastes.
Right.
We're talking about there's an executive director. Where's the funding coming from? How much is there, and who benefits?
That's a good question. The funding and you'd have to look at the impacts of what this actually is going to do, but basically they think their funding comes from several sources. They estimate, this is their estimate in fact, that it will cost $333 million over the 30-year life of the system. I think that's a bit low, because it doesn't recognize opportunity costs, and it doesn't recognize overlaps with other agencies who have to do work along this process, that is, the time of the staff members and so forth.
Well, they're well known for growing their budgets.
Right, exactly.
Well, it also wouldn't include the losses to the landowners, the losses in their value.
Right.
I mean, let's face it, if I was looking for land in Northern California, you put an HCP on a county's, on the broad landscape of a county, it's the last place I'd ever want to buy.
Well, even before this, home builders in East County were saying that regulatory costs just to conform to the city requirements and the requirements before this took place put another $30,000 to $40,000 into each house that they would have to recover on sale.
If you talk to any of them, they would be like, "Oh, but we need affordable housing."
Well, of course, exactly the same people. So however, from different sources, California has received $30 billion in federal funds. the U.S. says that they provided $750 million over 15 years, or $5 million a year. They, the HCP people, say that they will get revenue from these fees because, of course, each of these permits goes, you have to have a fee to pay for that, for new activities or new developments. They count on $160 million from new developments. They will receive partially fees from wetland fees. They count $23.5 million from that source. They count on federal and state monies, grants and so forth, which are have already been made of record. And they obviously are going to count on additional taxes. They already have a portion of collected fees, but they include the word future when they talk about revenue. So they estimate that even the existing efforts are going to cost $80 million, and that they will get $55 million from park bonds. Well, the people that voted for transportation bonds or park bonds didn't anticipate that their money would be going for habitat conservation.
And funding really the pockets of NGOs like the Sierra Club and the Native Plant Society and organizations like that.
Right.
Really to just have administrative play money while they literally play with the landowners in their interests.
Well, it's very interesting because they also have a scientific panel that... And this is a, you know, it's a very interesting process, but the scientific panel is made up of six PhDs from the biological sciences and one biologist, and...
Pretty Comptian to me.
Yeah.
The UC Berkeley guys got to get their money, too, you know.
Right, and Stanford and, you know, the various other places.
Yeah.
And interestingly, the species that they have picked to save happen to be some of the very same specialties that they study.
I thought,
looking at this plan and these various covered species, both listed and unlisted, what is it about East Contra Costa that makes these so rare? So I took advantage of the internet and looked up websites that had botanical and animal species to see where their habitat was. Yeah, that is on the scientific sites.
So did you look at the San Joaquin kit fox, which is one of the animals listed?
I didn't, but I looked at the longhorn fairy shrimp, the vernal pool tadpole shrimp, and the vernal pool fairy shrimp.
Now let's just inform the audience of what a vernal pool is. It's where a puddle of water happens to exist for a couple of weeks a year.
Right, at least during the winter.
Yeah, and that's suddenly given some sort of sacrosanct treatment and is called a vernal pool. And inside these vernal pools are the tadpole shrimps and other such important species as fairy shrimps. And I don't know what they do in the vernal pool, which by definition dries up and goes away. What happens to these?
They apparently bury in the mud, or at least some reproductive process takes place so that they're dormant during the dry period.
Okay.
And that's what I've read. And but anyway, these shrimp are found in one case all over the Central Coast Range from Contra Costa down to San Luis Obispo. Another in the tadpole found from Redding down to Merced and in Alameda County. Another one from Shasta County to Tulare to Solano to San Benito to Santa Barbara to Riverside.
To Riverside. Now, that's about 500 miles away.
Right.
Between here and there, these things exist everywhere. Go ahead.
And then for unlisted species, things like the tricolored blackbird, the mid-valley fairy shrimp, the Mount Diablo manzanita, and the big tar plant. Well, I looked at those, and... the Mount Diablo manzanita grows only around Mount Diablo, and the tricolored blackbird is throughout California, especially Northern California. The big tar plant in three areas, Alameda, Contra Costa, San Joaquin. So the point is that except for the Mount Diablo Manzanita, and if in truly it grows only on Mount Diablo, I'm not sure why the rest of East County is needed for that. But in my experience, Manzanita itself grows all over the state, and I've found that some of these scientific species are named after the finders. So if you find some variation in the scientific description, you can say, well, this is XYZ Smithi, or the next one would be XYZ Jonesi, or whoever happened to find it. So it's almost creative species identification, it seems to me.
Well, a lot of times, if it's just in a different county, they try to make it a different species. That's whether you're talking about fish or animals or plants.
You can get a grant to study it.
Right.
We have
right.
endangered Manzanita in this county as well. Now, I doubt if it's the same one, but I'll bet if the average botanist went out and looked at him, he'd be real hard-pressed to really see much of a difference. And like you say, Manzanita is all over the Sierras, it's all over the coast, it's all over California.
Right, exactly. Well, and as you mentioned, of course, we're not alone. There are HCPs spreading all over the place. And I did a quick check. In Northern California, there's an HCP or some variation or a current attempt in Solano, Yellow, Sacramento, San Mateo, Monterey, Kings, Kern, Placer, Mono, Sonoma, Santa Cruz, of course, with your long-toed salamander, San Benito, Fresno, and Tulare. In Southern California, there's plans in San Diego, Riverside, Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and L.A. counties.
That's a growth industry.
It is. In one website, they have a conference on HCP Taco to the Bay. So, obviously, even though California leads the states in the number of HCPs, it was anticipated by Congress in 1973 when they passed the Endangered Species Act, and in California got geared up in 1991 by the Department of Fish and Game. And, of course, then in 97 when Congress started appropriating money for the land acquisition program.
Now, you're saying how much money is going into just the Contra Costa HCP?
Their website, their estimate is that it will be $333 million over 30 years. Or
just
approximately $11 million a year.
All that money in the state of California going to that.
Well, and you can see that by, that's only Contra Costa, and with a listing of all these other counties, you can see how much money in the state.
Well, and all of America is paying for that. If you don't have HCPs in your county, you are paying for them in California, thanks to our Endangered Species Act, which is putting these funny shrimp that might appear, I presume they are barely visible. They're so small.
Well, I have a story that would maybe illustrate what happens. And this actually happened a number of years ago over on the coast near Jenner, between Sebastopol and Jenner. There's a Boy Scout camp. And they had a nice little creek, Austin Creek, which was dammed up to provide a swimming hole and a small canoeing and boating area.
This is in Monterey County, isn't it?
No, it's in Mendocino, I think.
Okay.
Or
well, they're after the Boy Scout camps wherever.
Well, true. Anyway, they suddenly one year the Corps of Engineers decided that they would have to tear out the small earthen dam that made this pool in the creek because the fairy shrimp might be endangered. So dutifully they did that. They tore them out. 2 years later, the Corps came back and said, well, we really didn't need you to do that. We have found this shrimp does exist in other places, different creeks over a ways and so forth. So here is a ongoing enterprise that had to completely change and cut out an activity, a recreation activity, that was totally unnecessary for them to do.
Classic.
Such things, I think, are happening all the time. You know, my experience when putting the flame of the countywide Santa Cruz County HCP out several years ago was the Department of Fish and Game, the Federal Department of Fish and Wildlife was there, and what they do is they create these best management practices that are to be applied to a landowner who may have land that has the potential for any one of, in Santa Cruz, it was 110 species to exist on their property. And so you'd have to agree to these standards. And by the time we defeated this thing by just breaking up the stakeholder process, the consensus process, was the leader of the this was done under the auspices of a fire safe council. They came in and took control of your land and didn't allow you to manage your land, and causing the fuel accumulation just to build up and creating the prospects for catastrophic fire. But you know they might end up saying, well, you've got the potential of six or seven of these species, and so you would end up with a 100 different best management practices that you had to contractually agree to follow. And the leader, a man who's who later became affiliated with the Chamber of Commerce, he had been a fire chief, said, well, you know, these would prevent people during the mating season of a long-toed salamander from being able to walk on their property. Well, sure enough, and, in one of these little backroom meetings of the NGOs and the federal government and the planning department, when you really pressed these folks on what it is their program would do, the point was, gee, if you can't go out and walk on your property to pull the weeds, how is it that a species that is benefiting from the management activity that might be ongoing at a property, how is it that they're going to benefit when the property simply falls back into a weedy condition that that would not support that species? And, of course, they had no answer for that because there is none. This is nothing but a land grab.
Well, it's very interesting because in order to get out from under this, you need to pay some money. What you do is you either... Well, in addition to making a commitment for long-term conservation measures on your property...
Which is really just land control. It doesn't conserve anything.
Right. You would either have to take some kind of mitigating measures, or you'd have to set aside a portion of your land for them to put in preserve or to keep an open space. Or you would have to pay for restoration or the enhancement of the habitat. In other words, you'd have to make it better than it was before for this particular species. And or you'd have to go out and buy land as an offset to set aside. And they even include buffer zones. And that is buffer areas outside of the affected area, so that in some cases they're anticipating that recreation areas might have to reduce fields of play or playgrounds in order to provide an appropriate buffer between the open space and the habitat. So it's a very interesting process.
Very interesting. It really does bring into play. If you watch the CD-ROM called Taking Liberty, done by Dr. Michael Kaufman and Stewards of the Range, you see how an HCP implements the Globalist Wildlands Project county by county. And, of course, you add them all up together, and it starts to look like that very disturbing map that's the centerpiece of the DVD, Taking Liberty, showing how over half of America is to be committed to these open space preserves, where people are to have no use, no ownership, no recreational benefits, nothing from over 50% of the land mass of the United States. And they do it with provisions like the HCP.
Right.
We'll be right back here in a couple of minutes at 321 of the Santa Cruz Radio Show.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right? Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Welcome back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. And before our audience is fully returned, let me talk about a new pamphlet that was issued just this week by Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. Many people, our listening audience and people around the country, have taken advantage of our first pamphlet called Understanding Sustainable Development, Agenda 21, A Guide for Public Officials. This has had major effects in a lot of communities where it has been distributed. You know, not all of our elected officials are part of this devious plan called Agenda 21. You know, we're not so fortunate perhaps here in Santa Cruz, because I think most of our elected officials know exactly what Agenda 21 is, and being as Comptian as they are, it's exactly what they want to bring about. The elimination of private property, the control of our children, really divesting parents of their rights and really their responsibilities for the rearing of the next generation. Instead, the Agenda 21 supporters want to eliminate private property and control the attitudes, values, and beliefs of our children. Well, if you want to cause your public officials and your neighbors and community members generally to understand what sustainable development is, how it's coming from our federal government, where they got it from on the international community, this short guide, easy to read, showing the wildlands map and with a lot of other references to the documents that actually support and prove the existence of a very, very devious plan to change the nature of America. You need to get a copy for yourself and order them in bulk so you can spread it around. Now, you can visit our website at freedom21santacruz.net. That's F21SC.net. You can see it in electronic form there, and you can order it. But this week, we've come out with another pamphlet, another easy-to-read pamphlet that'll give you a bird's-eye view as to what sustainable development is. It's called Transforming America, Sustainable Development, The Destruction of Your Rights, Creating Crisis, Shortage, and a Police State. You see, sustainable development is a lot more than just stealing everyone's property. It is the creation of a global police state. All of us want to fight against this, whether you're left or right. That's why here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, we don't identify ourselves with left, right, Democrat, Republican, liberal, or conservative. It's a battle between liberty and tyranny. And together, the right side's going to win, meaning liberty's going to win. But you got to get informed, and these two pamphlets are a great stepping stone to do that. So check out our website. Look at them electronically, order them in hard copy, and spread the word in your community.
And if you want to participate in our discussion, it's 1-888-245-4237, because we always want to hear from you.
Well, you know, when we talk about something like habitat conservation plans, they're, as Paul's indicated, they're all over the state of California, so there's a lot of information. And if we can combine an understanding of that information from county to county, showing the comparisons, showing the same stakeholders, people driving the stake through the heart of private property, through the heart of rural America, you know, we can begin to spread the word about what's behind it all, and then we can begin to reverse the trend. And
I don't want to put more money in that. I'd rather put more money in fixing the potholes so I can go back and forth to work.
Well, as a matter of fact, HCP, or the East Country Cost HCP anyway, covers rural roads.
for them to stop being used?
For anything any activity that is going to expand them or change them or interfere with the habitat. You know, it's very interesting that what they talk about in terms of disturbing the species. The Federal Endangered Species Act calls a taking as harassment or harm or pursuit or hunting, shooting, killing, trapping, capturing, or collecting various species. But what's that mean? What are the actual impacts, for example, of harassing a species? Well, it turns out that that includes disturbance from lights. So if a farmer put a light on his barn at night, you know, that might disturb the animals.
If my kid is riding his bike with his light on and it scares him,
it might keep the coyote away from the house.
And, it might, but, you know, that might be protected. I don't know. The harassment of wildlife from additional pets, the increased noise, the increased runoff water, increased recreation in the preserves, increased vehicle-related disturbance or mortality to wildlife, and increased chance of wildfire. Now, those are various impacts that are listed that might harm the species.
Well, and any person of reason can sit down in each one of those arguments and batter them back and show how actually the opposite is true, and that to have really a healthy ecology, human beings are necessary. You know, plants grow to their climax species, and that means generally a monopoly of a bully plant, whether it's native or non-native, it doesn't matter. The bully plants end up prevailing without man's management. And so when you take
right.
man off, and when you begin to tell man what he can and can't do, and he's got to get approval to, you know, as the great song from Chris Bond did down in Monterey that we played frequently on this show. You know, it's gotten to the point where even the farmer has to beg permission to do anything. And once we've divested human beings of the authority over their what it is over which they are responsible, you know, we don't have much chance of doing anything. And I think people who are out in nature understand that for nature to thrive, and my experience is in creating some very unusual plants on the property that we manage, it requires disturbance.
Right.
Because it's the unusual plant that gets bullied out fastest, and so it takes man going in there and playing around and changing things in order to create the kind of variety and diversity that you know, that people respond to, and that that does create for a wider and more diverse natural world.
Well, interestingly enough, that they include, of course, different kinds that include grassland, cropland, rural land, and I learned a new term. That means garbage land or land that is rubbish, basically. Various pastures and orchards. So those might have to be diminished in order to provide a habitat for species.
Well, I can tell you, too, that to take pasture land, grassland of European annual grass species, and convert that into anything other than itself is a huge, time-consuming, and expensive process.
Right.
And for them to suggest federal government to come into local communities and suggest that by abandoning productive agricultural land for the purpose of these things is just nonsense. It's so counterproductive to anything that's valued in society. And as they continue to succeed, we're going to wake up one day and we're going to find out that Americans don't have a landscape anymore, that we're dependent not just on the rest of the world for oil, we're dependent upon them for food and for all forms of our subsistence. And in the meantime, we've been reduced to drones subject to begging permission and sanction for anything that we might do.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about expense, and even in Sonoma County, where they're fighting the tiger salamander battle, the official website estimates that there will be $336 million in lost development opportunities over 20 years, $210 million in mitigation measures alone. So we're talking about millions and millions of dollars in each of these locations.
And in the meantime, we're all going to be jammed in. You know, you've done some excellent shows on smart growth, jammed into smart growth communities, where the prices of housing get higher and higher and higher until government
smaller and smaller.
Yeah, smaller and smaller units. People more stacked and packed with more limited transportation alternatives, while the mass of the lands, you know, in your county, 175,000 acres, are ruled essentially off limits to people.
Well, it's very interesting that that's one of the patterns that this business to lock up land and move people to the smart growth developments, and whether you do it by wild land measures or you know, the residential smart growth development or HCP or establishing preserves, whatever, it's still overall a failure to consider any other impact. In other words, the impact statements, and that's an interesting thing too, since it is a federal program, the program and the various, the EIR, are all printed in the Federal Register. And of course, I don't know anyone that reads the Federal Register, and I suspect, you may not, but, everything is laid out in the Federal Register because it is a federal program. Well, it impacts homeowners, ranchers, small and large businesses, impacts taxpayers, impacts the economy. None of that is taken into consideration. That's not part. The consideration is only in terms of the species to be saved or the idea that there has to be a habitat in this particular place, even though there are multiple locations where this species is found.
Well, and as a dad and a coach and, you know, somebody who's involved in youth, it impacts the kids. You know, we hear all the time, oh, you know, we have to have things for our kids to do.
Right.
We're
going
to be involved in gangs and all that, but no, that's not put a little league field out there.
Right.
Let's not let the scouts, you know, swim in their little lake because,
right,
you know, we've got to worry about these shrimp.
Well, another, you know, another couple other interesting patterns that I've noticed. One is their methodology. And it's probably, I came across a Fish and Wildlife Service booklet, which is entitled The Quiet Revolution. And that's exactly what's happening. It's very quiet. Not a lot of noise is raised, not a lot of hullabaloo about these plans, and they're just kind of slipped in with minimum public notice, only the required notice in federal cases, the Federal Register, or maybe a part of a calendar of something else on the Board of Supervisors, and no or very little input from the property owners affected. Oftentimes these public meetings where they try to arrive at, quote, consensus, unquote, are held or directed after the decisions have basically been made. So, the methodology.
They hold them when real people can go.
Right. The methodologies that they use are frequently the same for all these kinds of things. As you know, we had a Shaping Our Future effort in the county, which is slowly being implemented.
Patterned off of Santa Cruz's own local Agenda 21 program.
Right. Another pattern is that the players are often the same. The NGOs, the use of them, and getting their buy-in early. Many of them have what I would call interlocking directorates, where the same people show up on many different organizations.
Like the Bay Area Council?
Right, or ABAG, or, you know, you name it.
Here that would include Action Pajaro Valley, or Watsonville Wetlands, and certainly the Native Plant Society and the Sierra Club and Ecology Action. Or Save Our Shores. It's a small group of very active and committed people who are stakeholding the ends of other people's lives.
Right, and that's what thing they do. That's their thing.
Their profession.
Pursuing that. They're a professional, just about, right. In many cases, it is.
Oh, sure. They're trained, and like you say, they're all over the state. I know that you've got on this list for Contra Costa the red-legged frog.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the red-legged
right.
frog has either had HCPs or critical habitat areas in probably, I think it's 30 counties in California.
Right.
Millions of acres just stripped out from people because of a red-legged frog that happens, it seems to be everywhere.
Well, that's a good example because that isn't mentioned when they go to talk about that in the individual county. It's only mentioned, well, in this habitat, in this county, we have the red-legged frog. It's not brought out that, well, wait a minute, that frog occurs throughout the state, you know.
And every county is stealing property in defense of red-legged frogs. So,
right.
It's quite amazing. Paul, we have a caller, Will from Missouri.
Okay.
Will, are you with us?
I certainly am. I've got a specific question that I want to ask you, gentlemen, because you're so wise on these things. Through the 80s and the early 90s, actually starting in the early 70s, I've developed probably 1,000 or more lots in Oklahoma and in Washington from a subdivision standpoint, designing the lots. And I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of native growth protection easements, sensitive area boundaries, slopes, steep slope setbacks, wetlands or the old farm ponds, and stormwater detention and retention systems that I designed in. But I'm wondering whether or not there's been any feedback from that over the years as to what's happening to this land now. Those setbacks were all taken out as easements against the property owner, and so if they had a sensitive area in their lot, they have to pay property taxes on that, and of course they had the purchase price too. But if there's a native growth boundary or something like that, they can't go in and do any work in there. And now it's been 15 to 20 years. That must be an awful mess by now.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I would think so. The interesting thing that these HCPs, as the outgrowth of that regulation attitude, have included both urban, what I would call urban lands and wild lands. And here in Contra Costa, we have implemented, the board of supervisors implemented an urban limit line, and it doesn't seem to make any difference in terms of the habitat plans, whether the land is in the city boundary or inside the urban limit line or outside. They are going to cover whatever they need to cover. I suspect when I was partially for part of my growing up years on a ranch in California, the stock ponds that we created and the wetlands we protected and used, I think farmers were the original conservationists.
Mm-hmm.
Those things nowadays, to do that in light of this in an HCP would be untenable.
It's almost property suicide. I had a large plat, I think it was close to 200 acres near Everett, South Everett, and the original farming family put in a pond in a low area, and when they wanted to subdivide the land, we had wetlands biologists that came out there, and they had every plant that they found, they put a flag on one of those little wire sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to have our survey crews go in there and locate them all. But as it turned out, for a man-made created pond that was about an acre, they lost about 12 acres of land to development when it really just was completely man-made and had only been there about 45 years.
But I'll listen off air. Excellent broadcast. But I'm very concerned about these subdivisions, because I know when I was putting those plats together and writing the covenant and conditions that went with them, there was no provision for the maintenance of those sensitive areas, and it's always just kind of nagged me in the back of my mind. It must be a dreadful mess.
Well, that's why we need to repeal, not extend, the Endangered Species Act.
Thank you.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this, too, is that the way the process works, different agencies can be used. In Santa Cruz, as you mentioned, the fire departments and the wildlife and wildland interface. And in other places, here, for example, the Water Conservation District, different agencies can be used, or multiple agencies can be used to accomplish the same purpose. And it all boils down to more control, control, control. And in fact, one of their stated purposes of the HCP is to control land use decisions.
Yes.
So they want to tell you how and where you're going to live.
Well, and ultimately they're going to decide who gets to use what land. So, you know, it may be that there are some grand plans sitting down in these city centers for the use of your land, but you may not be the right person in their mind to do it. So you get squeezed out through the application of programs like habitat conservation plans, and then WWAWI, all of a sudden comes the Nature Conservancy, buys the poor landowner's property for a nickel on a dollar, and it ends up in the hands of somebody who's friendly with the existing regime. That's called public-private partnerships. We have another caller, Frank from Michigan. Frank, what is your question?
A couple of weeks ago, I think, the 5th of October.
Can you speak up a little bit, Frank? We're having a hard time hearing you.
Okay, on the 5th of October, is this better?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, you had a gentleman on by the name of Robinson from Pennsylvania describing the legislative draft.
Yeah, how laws are made.
As it sounds to me, the municipal corporations such as the United States, which according to a certain documented facts, cease to exist as a consummated municipal corporation. That is, they're bankrupted, they're insolvent, and as all corporate entities, if they're bankrupted, they're insolvent, they don't have legal standing. Furthermore, isn't it true that the municipal corporation of the United States is defined legally as the District of Columbia and its federal territories, and that specifically delineated as America, Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands? So their legal authority or jurisdiction extends only into what is legally defined as the United States.
Well, I don't know, Frank. You know, that's a subject in and of itself, and it's off the subject of the Habitat Conservation Plans or Endangered Species Act. But clearly, the kind of shenanigans that sits behind the establishment of Habitat Conservation Plans, the exorbitant costs of these things, have created a real mess for the federal government and for all the citizens of America, and does threaten us with a loss of self-determination in America and self-governance for the individual. So that may be a subject for another show, and if you want to hear a bit on that, you can go to our radio archives and listen to the 2-hour show with Wayne Hage last year, where there was some discussion of the corporate status of the American government.
Thanks for your call, Frank.
But Roy, before we continue and finish up with Paul, let's talk a little bit about the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz initiative to begin a process of identifying at least an individual in hundreds, if not a couple thousand counties.
Everywhere you can hear us, and then tell your friends.
And understand we can be heard everywhere,
over the various medium of transmission that this show goes out on. America needs to organize. The farm bureaus aren't going to organize the rural interests of this country. The Cattlemen's Association isn't. Timber interests have not. You know, we're under assault, and the assault evidences itself with things like the habitat conservation plans here in California and elsewhere, or critical habitat areas in your state, or just all the various little games and gimmicks, tools of the Endangered Species Act and other federal and state legislation that is like the Kelo case took the homes from those people in Connecticut. All of these little applications are taking the lands of rural America, and when they do that, they've taken the freedom of all Americans. So we need to begin to organize a real movement to roll back and the habitat conservation plans, repeal the Endangered Species Act, and
say no to community plans.
Well, that we get to that point too, absolutely. So if you're listening to us and you want to become part of that process, write us at advance@f21sc.net. Give us your name and your county, and we'll begin to communicate. And we'll begin to organize and synthesize a movement that can spread itself across the country. You know, it's a great testament to what citizen action can do if we look at the Minutemen and how they have mobilized public awareness and support for the natural boundaries of this country. And we need to move inside, and we need to say, preserve America for human beings.
Because we get a lot of great callers here, but we know that there's more people out there. You know, for every caller, there's probably a couple of hundred other people who might be listening who want to do something, and here's your opportunity.
Well, we're always asked, what can we do? And, of course, you've got to get yourself informed and, you know, get the guides, check out our website, dig into the website, because if you go to our advanced bulletin, there are just hundreds of articles, and go into our research center, and there are hundreds of documents that can help you with your specific concern as America begins to fray at the ends from an overactive government and massive federal agencies. So write us at advance@freedom21santacruz, and we'll get you on a list for communication as we begin to organize communication to our fellow citizens. We got a minute or so left, Paul. How can you wrap up this show for us?
Well, I just want to underline what you said about learning and educating others. Remember that bonds are not free. You end up paying about twice as much. Elect those people who really understand this. Don't forget to appeal things, decisions. Use your grand juries. Pester your legislators. And listen to Freedom 21.
Well, I want to thank you again for your great research and your good, solid contributions out in East Bay. And I'm hoping to hear how East Bay residents have stood up and just said no to this habitat conservation plan in Contra Costa County. Be with us next week. We're going to have another exciting show here on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Network. And Roy, until then,
have a good week.
Yes, have a good week.